You know what will keep you warm in the great white north? A little true crime with your host, Megs
and Jess.
Hello, Canadian true crime fans. I'm your host, Megs.
And I'm Jess.
How is it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. You had a new addition to your family member this week.
We did. We got a new puppy.
Oh, bless.
He's so cute. Marty McFly.
I mean, that is a very unique and gifted name.
Well, my son picked out the name because, like his mother, he loves Back to the Future. I love Back to the Future. So he always had said, oh, if we get another dog one day, I want to name him Marty McFly. And my daughter would say, I want to name it Rainbow Sprinkle Cupcake. And so I was like, well, you're out.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. But Marty McFly, we could probably do that. So we surprised them with a puppy. They had no idea that we were getting one. And it was so much fun. It was the best surprise ever. And yeah, he's so sweet. So he's our little Marty. He's doing really good. I mean, he sleeps through the night in his little kennel. He's just an easy dog. I mean, he's our third dog now, and he's probably the easiest dog we've ever had. So, and of course, he's a little Yorkie.
The best. Who doesn't love Yorkies?
Right?
I haven't been around puppies for so long because my dogs are 12 and a half. So my parents, as you know, have two little puppies, and it's like, I feel like the wind gets knocked out of me every time. They're so cute, but I'm like, oh my God, you need to just...
There's so much
work. We just need to slow down. Yeah.
They are a lot.
But they're worth it. Dogs.
They're awesome. Yeah.
I don't trust
they're a girl's
non-dog
best friend.
People.
Yeah.
They are.
I don't trust really non-dog people either. When someone says, I don't like dogs, I'm like, ooh, red flag.
I'm just going to slowly back
away from
you. Yes,
I'm
going to
back away from you and...
I know. It's definitely, they love you unconditionally. And I think, I don't know, I think that's the best feeling in the world. So
yeah, I agree.
Get a dog if you don't have one. Well, to start off the new week, you have a new puppy. I have a new case to tell us. And I don't think you know this one. I think this is something new to both of us. And this was actually quite interesting to research. So let's dive in, shall we? Today, I want to tell you about how a babysitting job led a 15-year-old 10th grade student to get inside a vehicle of an unknown man and drive off, never being seen alive again. This is the abduction story of Kelly Cook. Listener discretion is advised, as this episode contains sensitive topics, including abduction and murder. It is not recommended for young audiences. While we are not detectives nor journalists, we would like to thank those who followed this case and researched the facts. With your information, we can readily share this story with our audience. All victims deserve a voice. Let us begin. This story takes place in a small village called Standard. Standard is a quaint village located in the southern part of the province of Alberta. It is approximately 70 kilometers, or 50 miles from my American friends, east of the city of Calgary. Quintessential rural Alberta to its finest. Standard was originally settled by Danish immigrants, my grandfather actually being one of them. Their economy is based on the surrounding farming community and the energy industry. There are several oil and gas rigs in the vicinity. My grandfather and his family, like so many in Standard, were farmers in the village. The village itself is small and a place where everyone knows everyone. As of 2016, the population was 353 people. However, back in 1981, that amount was actually larger. There were 376 people in total. So Standard attracted farmers like my grandfather when they immigrated from Denmark, but it also attracted those wanting a quieter life outside the larger cities. That was exactly what Marion and Walter Cook wanted for their young growing family. In 1977, They traded the bustling city life in Montreal, Quebec, for the rural landscape in Alberta. Marion and Walter's oldest daughter, Kelly, was 12 when she left the only city she knew and moved to her new home in Standard. Kelly was a bright-eyed girl who was known to have an old-school soul. She had strong aspirations of one day becoming a lawyer, as she loved to talk about social justice issues.
Well, she was a good kid. She was very good at school, and she had plans for the future. She always was like that. Even when she was tiny, you know, she was 3 going on 90, always. She was very smart.
It was the 22nd of April, a Wednesday. 15-year-old Kelly Jane Evelyn Cook was at home in Standard with her parents, her young sister Marnie, and their younger brother Heath. Kelly was busy getting ready for school when the home phone rang at 8:20 a.m. that morning. Kelly was the first to answer the landline. The call was silent on the other end, so Kelly hung up. Immediately the phone rang again. Kelly answered. This time, a man spoke. He was inquiring about her babysitting services. Kelly was frequent to babysit those in the village, as most teenagers her age did. Kelly was the more popular babysitter in town, as she acted mature for her age and was considered a very thoughtful person. To earn a little extra money, she would babysit a couple times a week for different families in the same village. While it wasn't unusual for Kelly to get babysitting requests from new people, it was suspicious that she had no idea who the caller was. The man on the phone identified himself as Bill Christensen. He told Kelly he needed a babysitter that same evening from 8:30 p.m. till midnight. He told Kelly her friend highly recommended her. He even said which friend it was that gave him her phone number. Kelly was a bit hesitant at first because she didn't know a Bill Christensen. But after checking with her mother, and because Christensen was a common name in Standard, Kelly agreed and made arrangements for him to pick her up after dinner. Her mother also advised to go to school and see if anyone actually knew the man. Kelly went to school that day as normal, and because of the man's last name, which was Christensen, most people at her school just assumed it was, in fact, someone who was visiting the town because it was such a popular last name. It could have been someone's brother, uncle, cousin, a friend. So when Kelly got home from school, she assured her parents it would be fine for her to babysit for this Bill Christensen man. Her parents relented at first, but soon agreed to let their eldest daughter babysit and earn a little extra money. At 8:30 p.m. that evening, a full-sized North American cream-colored car pulled up outside Kelly's home. Bill pulled up right outside the Cook home, but he waited in his car. He never got out, which seemed a bit off-kilter to not only Kelly, but especially her parents. Kelly's younger brother stood at the top of the stairs as he watched his oldest sister leave the house. He vividly remembers exactly what she was wearing that night. Kelly's younger sister, too, remembers that night as she was watching from the basement window. It's dark out by that point, and both siblings, you know, remember, and even the parents, remember exactly the car. Of course, they didn't take the license plate down. That wasn't even, an inkling in their minds. But they couldn't, because of the reflection in the window of the car, they couldn't actually physically see the man's face. They just, because the headlights are beaming, and that's all they basically see. But they knew the color of the car, which was cream. So Kelly says goodbye to her family, and she gets inside the cream-colored car. She reassured her family she would call as soon as she got to his house. That was a very specific rule in the Cook household. If either sister were to babysit, they were required to call their parents and let them know they had arrived safely. Kelly's mom watched from the front window as her daughter got inside the car and drove off. Her family never received that safety phone call. Like any concerned parent, they were immediately worried when their daughter didn't call as she said she would. They waited. An hour passed. 2 hours. 3 hours. Kelly's mom then started calling people in the community to see if anyone knew this Bill Christensen. Again, there are less than 400 people in this village. All the people she spoke to said they had never heard of him. Then, finally, on the fourth hour of her daughter still being silent and nothing from her, her mom called the Royal Mounted Police to report Kelly missing. Kelly's younger sister, Marnie, remembered many events from that fateful evening, but waking up around 12:30 a.m. that night to have the police sitting in their living room was one. Alarm bells did actually go off immediately, as it was very out of character for Kelly. Police did know that Christensen was a very common surname in Standard, but they also discovered there was, in fact, no Bill Christensen in the village, nor any relatives that had heard of him. The RCMP and Kelly's father, Walter, immediately got in their car and drove around the village with their sirens on, looking for Kelly. At this point, there was no 24 to 40 hour window time. It was immediately, let's start searching for her. Unfortunately, their overnight search came up empty. And it became apparent quite quickly that they believed Kelly had been given a false name. The community at this point was also very quick to gather in order to help find Kelly Cook.
You all know why we're here. On the 22nd of April, Kelly Cook was abducted from her home in Standard. She hasn't been seen or heard of since. There's every reason to believe that she may still be alive. The man who abducted Kelly Cook, he may very well live in this area. He may live on one of these farms. So you may be talking to him today. Please be careful.
It's a small community where everyone knows everyone. It's not even like, oh, you can borrow sugar from your neighbor. It's the fact that most people want this tight-knit community to remain safe and keep an eye out for everyone. So within hours of Kelly getting inside that unknown man's car, police already had 350 officers, neighbors, and even strangers from neighboring towns searching the 1,250 square mile radius on foot, horseback, in vehicles, and helicopters. And again, this is 1981. It's a lot of people for a town that basically has 350 people. And it's not a very big area. If you've, you know, if one day you go through Standard, it is actually quite small. I know from being there, and it's very tiny. So, but it's one of those places where you basically drive through the entire town. Like, you can drive through in basically 10 minutes. Every house in Standard was searched, including abandoned buildings. No evidence was ever found of Kelly. Every vehicle that drove through the area was stopped and searched, and every person was questioned. These searches went on for days. Kelly's mom, aunt, grandma, sister, and brother all went searching for Kelly. And this is the ultimate despair for a mother, just not knowing. With all of that help, there was no trace of Kelly or this mysterious Bill. The days soon turned into weeks. The police and media were at the Cook family home on a regular basis. There was still no sign of Kelly. The case hit a dead end. The RCMP decided to finally release Kelly's case to the public, asking for their help. Finally, a small break in the case would happen weeks after Kelly's disappearance. This one tip in particular gave police cause for concern. A woman who worked as a phone operator for the company AGT in Calgary saw the news clip on Kelly's case and immediately called police. This operator received a phone call from a payphone in a small village called Hussar, 20 minutes north of Standard. When the operator answered the phone call between 10 and 10:30 p.m., the same night Kelly went missing, it gave her unsettling images. Upon answering, the operator heard a girl scream. The scream was so loud, it caused the phone operator to remove her headset. And then, silence. The phone went dead. Authorities believe it may have been Kelly screaming on the other end. This was the worst possible news the Cook family could have received. Some of the locals told the RCMP there was a clean-shaven, dark-haired man at the Standard Hotel bar. This dark-haired man had also frequented the local co-op grocery store in Standard and the service station. Like many densely populated areas, this stranger stood out for being precisely that, a stranger in the village. People kind of know when you're in a small town or a village, if you know instantly when you don't fit in. So it was very obvious to the town folk that this man was not from Standard. No one had ever seen him before. The stranger walked into the service station in Standard to use the phone inside as the payphone outside was out of order. The service station manager inside agreed to let him use the phone. He stood beside the dark-haired man while he made the phone call to make sure, in fact, it was a local call. Apparently, I guess he said that he had been, as he says, duped before. People would make long-distance phone calls and that he would end up having to pay for. The service station manager overheard this man's phone call, and guess what the conversation was about? Babysitting. RCMP believed that the dark-haired man in the service station was none other than the man who identified himself to Kelly Cook as Bill Christensen. And sure enough, police were able to trace that phone call from Kelly to Bill in that local service station. I was very impressed because this is 40 years ago, and the fact that they were able to trace the phone call from Kelly's landline to the service station payphone is inside is quite, I feel like, quite amazing for back then. So they were able to determine it was, in fact, from the service station. Earl Peterson, who was the investigator assigned to the case, asked the service station manager to describe the man who used the phone. Quote, "To me, he looked like a farmer. I don't remember him wearing a hat, but he was rude. Dark hair, possibly curly, no gray. A man in his 40s, approximately 5'9", 5'10". That same description was used throughout the town of those who encountered this dark-haired stranger. He was referred to as being rude and or arrogant. The service station manager stated that it sounded as if the strange man actually knew the person he was talking to on the phone. His demeanor on the phone was very contrasting to the rudeness the manager experienced. There was more of a kindness on the phone to the person he was talking to on the other line. Police drew up a sketch according to the description from the service station manager and the town folks who also crossed paths with him. The man was described as roughly 5'10", medium built, and between 30 to 45 years old. When the black and white sketch was released, tips poured in, but sadly none of them led to finding out any more information about what happened to Kelly Cook. Police came up empty. They did, however, search every Bill Christensen across Canada, which led to 35 interviews with that namesake. Again, a dead end. It was determined the name Bill Christensen was just a phantom name. It's as if he almost knew that Christensen was a popular surname in the town or in the village of Standard, and that's why he picked it. On Sunday, June 28, 1981, just 2 months shy after Kelly's abduction, a few local boys were riding their motorcycles near an irrigation canal at the Chin Lake Reservoir near Tabor, Alberta, roughly 2 hours outside of Standard. They discovered a body washed up on shore. The water levels in June were relatively low due to a drought in the area, and because of this drought, the boys on their motorcycles were able to see the body lying face down on the shore. Jerry Nelson was one of the boys who discovered the body on the sand inlet that day. He stopped and waited for his four friends to catch up. He stayed away about 10 feet.
You know, she was face down and head towards the west, so we came upon her feet, not knowing that it was a female at that time, not being able to tell.
The teens soon flagged down a boater and asked him to call police. Dental records would then confirm it was, in fact, 15-year-old Kelly Cook. Jerry learned of that discovery a few days later, and 40 years later, it still haunts him. The RCMP would inform Walter Cook at his place of work that fateful day.
And the RCMP had actually gone to Dad's work and told him that they had found her. and that he needed to go home, obviously, and tell everyone, but that the news media did have the information as well, and that there was a risk that if we were listening to the radio, that that's how we could have found out about it. And so one of Dad's co-workers and friend drove him home to tell us.
Kelly's lifeless body was found fully clothed in the reservoir. She was fully bound and weighed down with two cinder blocks tied to her side. There were ropes around her body, her ankles, her hips, and her shoulders. Kelly's body was severely decomposed as it had been in the reservoir water for a lengthy amount of time. Investigators determined the perpetrator had gone to a lot of work making sure Kelly's body had never been found. Thankfully for police, this Bill Christensen man was ill-formed on what he was supposed to do in order to actually dispose the body. Jerry has stated he thinks Kelly was deceased before she went into the water, which makes sense because if you were conscious and someone threw you into the water while you were tied up, your first instinct is to try and get the ropes loose. In Kelly's case, that was not apparent. The ropes were all completely tightly bound together upon her discovery, which would make sense that she was probably either already deceased or she was unconscious when she was thrown in. Her autopsy revealed that there was no evidence of sexual assault, and her cause of death was most likely suffocation. But because of her decomposition from the water, it's not 100% accurate. Chin Lake was dragged and searched by divers, but no more evidence was found. Unfortunately for the police, the discovery of Kelly's body did not provide any new leads. A funeral was held in Standard, and bells rang out in memory of the young girl who died a tragic death. The church was filled to capacity. Her entire class was also in attendance. This case became a homicide. They requested the help of the FBI to create a profile of the dark-haired man falsely known as Bill Christensen. Authorities questioned over 2,000 suspects and found nothing of any substantial evidential value. The case then stalled. Police are convinced that whoever abducted Kelly that night had been planning the crime beforehand. Having chosen a common name such as Bill Christensen proved to police the abduction was a carefully planned crime, and he was clever enough to use an alias, especially one that was so commonly, you know, prevalent in the small town. And it made the suspect fit into the 376 people that lived in Standard. It also made police question whether this was his first abduction. If this was, because it was so well calculated, they think that possibly this might not have been his first victim. It was now determined authorities really needed the public's help. A TV clip even showed a reenactment of the crime. As the case went longer and longer, it became worrisome for the Cook family. This case actually became the first of its kind in Western Canada to be taken to the Behavioral Sciences Unit at the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. They created a profile of who this Bill Christensen would possibly be.
This is from Quantico. So, for example, marital status. He is currently unmarried. He has previously been married, probably more than once. Each of the previous marriages ended bitterly, with the offender exhibiting a great deal of animosity toward his spouse. It is probable that the offender frequently abused his spouse or spouses and came to the attention of law enforcement as a result of domestic disturbance complaints. Personally, I find it interesting, but I'm not prepared to put all my eggs in that basket.
We had discussed that with the Punky case too, how they had created this profile of what this man could possibly be. And it's really interesting what they do come up with, because there's so little evidence to go on this Bill Christensen person. The profile did provide a lot of information of who Bill Christensen could possibly be. The composite drawing of Bill Christensen flooded in loads of tips. They had close to up to 500 tips after the picture of him had come out. every time a tip came in, it had to be investigated. Unfortunately, all of the tips that poured in led to nothing, yet investigators had to follow through. By 1990, they had 2,200 suspects. Isn't that crazy? Like, for such a small little village, you had that many possible suspects. While there have been several people of interest in the case, no one has ever been arrested. Quite a few suspects appeared more interesting than others, but ultimately they were eliminated. There were, however, four possible suspects who stood out over the rest of police. Chester Keith Bordelon, who had a prior conviction of assaulting a 15-year-old girl in town, was a person of interest. Unfortunately, there was just no evidence to arrest him, and he ultimately died in 2008. Robert Edward Brown stabbed a 16-year-old girl in a neighboring town, then burned her body. He was arrested in 1983 for that crime. He was living an hour outside of Standard when Kelly went missing. However, a fellow inmate stabbed Robert to death in 1986. Again, there was no evidence to convict him or arrest him. Dennis Melvin Howe was another person of interest. He stuffed a 9-year-old girl's body into a fridge after raping and murdering her. He was in and out of prison for assaults toward women. He was last seen in 1983 and was wanted by the Toronto police. No evidence led police to arrest him in connection with Kelly, but he was living outside the town when her disappearance happened. The last person of interest which caught police was Terry Arnold, who lived in Strathmore, which was 30 minutes outside of Standard. He is believed to have raped and murdered dozens of girls across Canada and the US. Some believe Kelly was his first victim. Again, police were not able to make an arrest as there was for lack of evidence. As new tips rolled in, more and more suspects came in. Some of the tips that came in were completely made up, using your bad neighbor, for example, or an estranged spouse you wanted to get back at. So it was frustrating for police too, because they had to look at every single tip they got in, but it also wasted a lot of time because they just weren't of any interest.
The thing about, remember in Punky's case, that the guy who was eventually convicted, he was a suspect all along.
Exactly. So I think that's also why police, you know, and of course, when you look at previous previous people that have, you know, assaulted women or killed children, right. Of course, they take that into effect, especially that if they were living in the neighboring towns or even in Standard. But, you know, you have to have some type of evidence or something to arrest people. Just because they did that to someone else doesn't necessarily mean that they did it to her. And because, you know, they looked at a lot of previous men that had raped these young girls, but Kelly wasn't raped. She was fully clothed. And there was no sign of sexual assault. So that was also threw police off. And interesting enough, though, this is what's fascinating, too, is on April 18th, 1981, just 4 days before Kelly's disappearance, this Bill Christensen actually called another girl in town to babysit, a 17-year-old girl whose name is still unidentified. This 17-year-old girl was a figure skater and had been featured in the local newspaper. She also happened to be another top babysitter in Standard. There have been unconfirmed rumors that this Bill actually called the local school a month before Kelly's disappearance to specifically ask about the local figure skater featured in the paper. Somehow he did acquire her number, and it would make sense if in fact the school did release her number to him. Again, it's a town of 376 people. Everyone knows everyone. If he said, "I'm Bill Christensen, I'm such and such nephew, and I want to do a story on your figure skater," the principal or whoever could have easily given her number to him.
Well, and there was no probably, I mean, now people are protected by privacy laws.
Exactly. The young figure skater had no idea who Bill Christensen was when he called her, only that he said he was new to town and that he needed a babysitter. He also told this figure skater his name was Bill Christensen. She turned him down as she was busy that evening, but she offered her two friends' names in return. One was Kelly Cook, who she had figure skated with. The 17-year-old teenager didn't think much of it until a few days later when she went to school on April 23rd, 1981. She attended school like any other day. When she arrived at school, the principal made an announcement telling students Kelly Cook was missing and does anyone know her whereabouts?
I still remember sitting at my desk, and when it came on, I just froze, and I'm like, oh, I was so scared. And I didn't know the impact at that time.
That same figure skater would come forward and tell the principal about her received phone call from a Bill Christensen and that she had actually given Kelly's number to him.
I thought, okay, he's new to the town, and Christensen is a very popular name in Standard, so I said yes. I said Kelly Cook, and I figure skated together, and so I gave her name, and I thought everything was fine. And then when I went to school on Monday, there was an announcement over the intercom that does anyone know the whereabouts of Kelly Cook? And I went to the office, and I said, yes, I do. I know, and I just had this horrible feeling with me that, oh no, what have I done?
Police then kept a close eye on the figure skater for actually quite a while because she was apparent to be the original target of Bill Christensen. From that moment on, the figure skater blamed herself for Kelly's disappearance. It changed her life forever. She says to this day, she wished she could have taken back that dreadful phone call. It became a question of, what if I had said no to that night but said yes to the following days? She realized soon on after Kelly's body was discovered, the figure skater said it could have been her. She has lived with the guilt all these years about someone losing their life because of her. That phone call to the figure skater was traced to the Standard Hotel bar. The staff at the hotel remembered overhearing a man talking to a babysitter over the phone. They remember him clearly as he had been rude to them when he asked to use the phone. So this alone demonstrates premeditation in the abduction. It also shows Kelly was not the initial target. Kelly was the backup babysitter. To make matters worse, the killer, this so-called Bill Christensen, was still at large with no prime suspects at hand. The trail to find Kelly's killer was growing cold. Despite that, the Cook family refused to give up. Kelly's case has never been solved. 4 decades later, it still remains open as a cold case. Even with the $130,000 reward from the Village of Standard, no one has ever come forward stating they know who the real man who's killed Kelly was. Despite this being a cold case, in 2016, the case was reopened. Authorities are hoping the public can provide some information that will heat up this mysterious case. The Calgary RCMP has a room filled with boxes stacked on top of one another right up to the ceiling about information on Kelly Cook's case. The RCMP interviewed suspects all across Canada. What will it take to move this case forward after 40 years of being cold? The old investigator on the case, Earl Peters, remains optimistic on the case that it will be solved. A deathbed confession could be one, but so far there have not been any. They would like nothing more than the correct name of this Bill Christensen. Sergeant Jason Zazulak, an Alberta RCMP Major Crimes Unit, has recently discussed some newer tips that have come forward.
The investigators, as they work through these carefully, that's what we'll be seeking to find this person, and ultimately we would like to, if the person is still alive, be able to sit across the table from them in a proper interview and convince them that now is the time to tell the truth. Now is the time to explain whatever happened on that day, in those days. Now is the time to tell us, and whatever consequences come of that, it's time.
To this day, Kelly's case remains a priority. Further DNA analysis is a proactive strategy they are working on. The DNA from Kelly's case in 1981 was tested, but they are hoping to retest it as well. To this day, there are 40 people of interest. The stranger who went by Bill Christensen would be roughly 70 to 85 years old today, if the description given back in 1981 by the service manager was, in fact, accurate. Like any unsolved case, the family of Kelly Cook and the community of Standard, Alberta deserve answers. Kelly's younger sister has stated, "I miss what she'd be. I miss that she should be sitting at the table with us." 40 years later, Kelly Jane Evelyn Cook would be 55 years old. If you have any information about this case, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing to our show. If you haven't already, please tell your friends about our little show and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. True Crimes in the Great White North is a crime series with new episodes every Fridays. For updates or to see photos from this case, please follow us on Instagram at Great White North Crimes and or join our Facebook page, True Crimes in the Great White North. Have questions? Please email us at truecrimesgwn@gmail.com.
Wow, well, thank you, Megan. I've never heard that case before. You know, a case like this, I strongly feel like someone knows something.
Exactly.
Someone knows something, and it's just a matter of time.
Well, that's what they were saying to, you know, this case. And I think, and, you know, her sister said the same thing. You think after 40 years, it just gets easier and easier. And it does to an extent, she said, but it's still, you're left lingering with the unknown answers of who did this to her. And you know, Kelly's parents have both passed now, but, you know, this so-called Bill Christensen, it's interesting because they question the fact, like, well, did he must have told someone? I mean, or maybe he went his entire life not saying one single thing, which happens all the time. But they're just hoping that someone knows something, that someone might peek. And that's why I thought it would be important to retell this case. And yes, Bill Christensen could be 85 years old and have gotten married and had kids and grandkids and all these things. But maybe, I don't know, maybe his conscience will break and he will admit what he did, and who knows?
Well, and even if somebody, maybe he didn't make a confession to anybody, usually, you know, I've read cases before where the wife was like, you know, their behavior was off. Mm-hmm. They kind of changed after that time, you know, like there's just something that kind of doesn't make sense, mm-hmm. and that questions them. But yeah, I mean, you know, nobody says anything.
No. And it's the fact that the phone operator had gotten that call, and, you know, it's just one of the things, because she didn't think to call police because she also thought maybe it could have been a prank call. Like, and that was not that we pranked called operators, you know, when we were kids, but back then, I mean, she just got so many random different types of phone calls that I think it just, she said it definitely freaked her out a bit, but then she didn't know if it was a joke. And it's hard to know things like that. You just don't know. Well, yeah. Please keep in mind, I'll put the information on our Instagram and also on the on our podcast information. If, I don't know, maybe someone knows someone. I mean, it's someone knows something, because it's just word of mouth and getting the cases out there. And I think it's important to shed light on cold cases, because I love when they get solved. Thanks for listening, everyone, and stay tuned for next Friday for a new episode.
You know, people think that after a certain amount of time that you're better, that you're healed and your heart is better. And that's just simply not the case. Time helps for sure, but the story seems to forever be evolving, and I think that's a little unsettling. It's unsettling to wonder if, I hope that I've never met him. I hope that I've never trusted him, that he's never come into my home.